Who am I?
Why do I feel this way?
How come my life doesn't work?
How can I be happier?
Call us. We'll talk. Open Air with Zen teacher Sherry Huber, hosted by Michael Gray. Every Tuesday from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. on KZSU Stanford. 90.1 on the FM dial, on the internet at kzsulive.stanford.edu. Be there. And here we are.
We are here.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I've noticed that there's a part of me that really likes hearing my own voice.
Is that right?
So let me just talk here for a while and listen to the beauty of my...
I would imagine that there are a number of folks who could confess to that same thing, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to Open Air with Sherry Huber.
And isn't it interesting that the sound of other people's voices can be so annoying, but ours can be so endlessly entertaining? My teacher used to talk about when people would be making noise, like, for instance, music that one doesn't enjoy. You know, like little kids will sit and bang on pots, or people can play drums endlessly. It's like when you're making noise, it's really fun and entertaining. When you're listening to it, it's not the same thing. I wonder if it kind of, you know,
absolutely,
the sound of our own voice sort of follows along the same pattern.
Absolutely. Could be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess we need to check in with some other people to find out. You tuned into KZSU Stanford, Open Air with Sherry Huber. Sherry, you've been a Zen teacher for many years. And what are we going to be talking about today?
Well, of course, we can talk about anything people are interested in, because that's the beauty of a call-in show. They can call in and tell us what they would like to talk about.
Yes.
But if they choose not to do that, one of the things that I know that we have a shared interest in is a quote by W. Somerset Maugham that could possibly set the tone for a discussion for us.
Absolutely.
So do you have that for us?
I do.
Is now a good time?
Let me just give out a few key pieces of information. The first piece is that we are very, well, I'll speak for myself, I am very excited to announce that we have, learning how to talk here, we have archives of Open Air with Sherry Huber available on your website. And they're available at this moment right now.
Is that true?
That's true.
Oh, my goodness. Of all the shows?
All of the shows back to November 21st of last year.
That is very fun.
2002.
So anybody who has the ability to listen to this over the internet can go to the website and click in and listen to any show that they want to.
Absolutely.
That's very fun. I confess, I have no idea how that would work.
But you've heard of the internet?
Yes. Oh, yes. I'm up to speed on that. And I actually have speakers sitting next to my computer. They're not hooked up. So I can imagine that that's all part of that. If they were, for instance, and I went there and clicked, that I could do that. So that's very impressive.
Yes.
Thank you for doing that.
My pleasure. A lot of people helped in that effort, so that's great. That website is sherryhuber.com. That's spelled C-H-E-R-I-H-U-B-E-R.com, and there are a couple of buttons there right on the homepage that will take you to the archives. And for people who want to join our conversation today, please give us a call at 650-723-9010. We'd love to hear from you. So, Somerset Maugham said, "If a nation values anything more than freedom, it will lose its freedom. And the irony of it is that if it is comfort or money that it values more, it will lose that too."
Isn't that striking?
That's amazing.
At the monastery, and I think very shortly at the Zen Center here in Mountain View, we're going to begin reciting a little thing before and after our sitting. And the gist of it is that if you want to end suffering more than anything, you will end suffering.
Yes.
And that if you don't, if there's something that you value more than ending suffering, you won't end suffering. And that if you're suffering, the thing that you can know is you value something more than ending suffering.
Yes.
And it really appeals to me because it just clarifies what's going on.
Absolutely.
And this strikes me the same way.
Yes.
Now, the idea that if we value something more than freedom, we will lose our freedom.
Yes.
And that if what that is that we value more is comfort or money, we'll lose that too.
Yes. Yes.
So that's just an intriguing sequence of notions to put together. And of course, those of us who do awareness practice are not surprised by that.
Yes.
Because it's that whole notion of attempting to be safe, we reinforce fear.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so every time we make a choice for something other than freedom, we choose not to have freedom.
Yes.
Every time we try to make ourselves more secure, we make ourselves more vulnerable and anxious.
Uh-huh.
And it's the paradox that people of Zen just adore. And I think that the love of the paradox is that that it does capture what is so.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, it's fascinating what you were talking about with the saying at the monastery. It just makes it crystal clear what's going mm-hmm. on. I'm choosing to suffer, or I'm choosing to be free of that.
Yeah. So today you're wearing a worry is not preparation T-shirt.
Yeah. Worry is not preparation.
And I love that T-shirt because there it is. It's one of those places where we can get confused. I'm doing my part here. I'm worrying. And so I think it's part of, there's one part of appeasing the gods because, I'm performing this ritual of worrying,
yes.
which is going to hold things at bay.
Yes.
Also, it is the thing that I do instead of ending suffering.
Uh-huh.
So if we go back to that little saying, then the thing that we know is, if I'm worrying, I am perhaps appeasing the gods, perhaps dealing with the anxiety that I have, giving a vent or an outlet to the anxiety I have. Perhaps what I'm doing is creating and perpetuating the anxiety, but I am not ending suffering. I am worrying.
Right.
And so when I recognize that I'm suffering, I can know that the reason that I'm suffering over this is that I am choosing worrying over ending suffering.
Yes.
So my choices become more clear, more simple at that point.
Absolutely.
Not necessarily easier,
right.
because if I try to break a habit like worrying, then all sorts of things arise that don't feel like freedom, don't feel like ending suffering. And yet each one of those is the thing that I need to address next in order to reach that place of freedom that I'm seeking.
Yes, yes. And so the T-shirt says, worry is not preparation. And what occurred to me is something that you talk a lot about, which is one process does not lead to another.
Mm-hmm.
So worry is worry, and preparation is preparation.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
they don't need yeah. to meet.
They
don't meet.
Yes, they don't. And yet, worrying can feel so productive. Right? I mean, it's
yes.
really it really feels like doing something.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking of all of the things that could go wrong, imagining what I would do in any scenario. And so it feels very productive. And preparing, well, preparing is interesting. So I'm going to do a big presentation. Well, the thing that I run into immediately, of course, is I don't know what's going to happen. So I make up something that's going to happen. Like, for instance, if I'm going to do a week-long program somewhere, then I know how many hours out of the day I'm going to be presenting. And I know what the topic is, and I know I would like people to start out here and I would like them to get here. But I actually don't know what's going to happen. So I can probably successfully prepare the first day.
Mm-hmm.
If I go much past that, then I'm in danger of not being open to what's going on currently
uh-huh.
because I'm trying to follow my roadmap.
Yes. Yes.
And of course, if I don't have anything to draw from, and I haven't created a whole week's program, then I'm going to be in trouble because, well, I get through the first day and I realize what needs to come next, but I don't know what that is because I don't have anything created for that. So the preparation can be everything that I've done in my entire life that I'm going to bring to this. And then with that kind of preparation, I can be open to whatever arises. But imagining things that will probably never happen is just simply not helpful. What it does is create in me a level of anxiety that makes me need to worry more so that I'll have something to do with that energy that I'm generating. It makes me less capable of being in the moment, less able to draw upon the information that I have at my disposal to create something that's going to be helpful. So yeah, one process doesn't lead to the other, and we just get them all mushed together.
Yes.
And then, of course, we wonder why
it doesn't... And we start crossing our fingers.
That's right, and why it doesn't feel better.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Fascinating. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber. We're talking about worry and fear and freedom and liberation. If you'd like to join our conversation today, please give us a call, 650-723-9010.
And I think comfort was in there, wasn't it?
Comfort, absolutely.
Yeah, which is a fascinating one for me.
Yes.
Because I've long suspected, now of course, you know, I'm a German Aries 8 who is a student of Zen Buddhism. So
8 meaning on the Enneagram.
On the Enneagram. It means I would, if I were to play football, I would not need a helmet. You know, this is one of the hardest heads in the history of humanity. And so doing hard things is very appealing to me. I like it.
Yes.
I thrive on challenges and that sort of thing. So it seems to me that with an issue like comfort, because it's true, the more we try to be comfortable, the more uncomfortable we become.
Mm. Because the standards become so high.
Yeah, and because the more I'm looking to make sure that I'm comfortable, the more things that I find I'm uncomfortable with. Right? So, you know my little story about that with the wine? I don't know if I've ever told you this, but we start out, somebody gives us some wine, and you know it's great. It's, you know, it's pink and it's really pretty and tastes like strawberries, and we think this is a really good thing. And then we go along, and somebody comes over and they bring a bottle of wine that costs $5, and we think, you know, this is ridiculous because why would you need that? But we taste it, and in fact we can see that it's pretty good, especially with the dinner. And then, you know, we go along and we're kind of moving up in the world, and we've moved through a $10 bottle of wine and a $15 bottle of wine, and now it's not unheard of for us to have a $30 bottle of wine.
Yes.
And in fact, if somebody came at us with a $10 bottle of wine, we would just say, no, thank you. I'd rather not drink. I'll have water, please. And so we go along with enjoying more and more wines, and we're spending more, and we're becoming quite the little connoisseurs.
Uh-huh.
And pretty soon, there we are in a cave somewhere in France, and we are among this select group of people who are going to open and taste the most expensive bottle of wine on the earth.
Yes.
And so it happens, and it's in our glasses, and we take a sip, and you know what our experience is going to be? Huh. You know, I don't think this is any better than that. Do you remember that little bottle of wine we had in...
And I flew all this way to...
That's right. And gosh, and so here, now I've gotten myself to the point where I am disappointed over the most expensive wine on the earth. I was perfectly happy with this strawberry, whatever it was.
Fruit juice.
Yeah, so we go along in that way with something like comfort. And in the pursuit of comfort, becoming more and more and more and more and more uncomfortable.
Yes.
Until finally we can make ourselves miserable all the time.
In any situation.
Yeah, in any situation. You know, we now have the Jaguar with the leather seats or whatever it is. And, you know, I don't think these seats are any more comfortable than the Lexus.
And
do
they're
you?
Not even heated.
That's right. So knowing that about ourselves, I think it is just intelligent to take care of something like comfort immediately.
Uh-huh.
To get to the place of realizing, no, I can be comfortable anywhere with anything.
Uh-huh.
Because comfort is an internal experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not external. I think as a nation, we've proved that to the entire world. We have everything to make us comfortable, and we're still largely miserable. Now, maybe that's just a projection, but it does seem to be the case. We don't we don't look like a happy nation of people. And so if we realize that I can be happy anywhere, doing anything, mm-hmm. under any circumstances, I can be comfortable with whatever because I know how to be present with circumstances as they are, and I know how to make myself happy no matter what's going on,
mm-hmm.
then it's this kind of thing that W. Somerset Maugham is pointing at. It's not a problem for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't have to give up our freedom for anything.
Yes.
We don't have to trade it for a promise of comfort that's not going to be fulfilled, or for security that nobody can in fact guarantee, safety
yes.
that cannot, you know, a promise of safety that can't be delivered. Because we know that here we are, and it's fine, exactly the way it is. In
yes.
fact, we're living life the way life is, I suspect, meant to be lived, which is on life's terms.
Uh-huh. In sync with life.
Yeah.
Yes. I had a sense as you were talking of, I choose this.
Mm-hmm.
I choose to be comfortable.
Yes. I choose to be with life. I choose to go along with what is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not easy. I can give you an example from my very own life experience. I went out yesterday afternoon, and I played golf.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the most miserable experiences of my life. You know, I said after a while, you know, I don't expect to play well. That's not the point. But I expect to hit one decent shot in the entire game, and I didn't even achieve that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was so bad. Just so bad. And it's hard to say, you know, this is fun. Because, of course, if it were always like that, I wouldn't play the game, let's face it. You know, I play
yes.
because once in a while I hit the ball well.
Yes.
So I'm not saying that it's easy to do this. I'm just saying that it's worthwhile.
Uh-huh.
You know, my favorite Jesus quote that Jesus never said, but I have that picture of him.
He would have said.
Yes, he probably would have said this. He's telling people, I never said it was easy. I said it was worth it.
Uh-huh.
So uh-huh. that it's that kind of, it's certainly not easy to get to a place of being comfortable anywhere. I suspect, though, that it is easier than spending one's whole life trying to alter externals to achieve a level of desired comfort.
Right. Because when we become aware of that process, we realize that there's no end to it.
Oh, it yes, it's insatiable.
Yes.
Yeah. So sometimes, you know, we talk about the hungry ghosts and that energy-sucking system that follows us around through life, causing us to be dissatisfied with just darn near everything.
Yes.
Yeah. If we put that to rest as early on as we possibly can, or at least make a commitment to working on that the best we can, then we really increase our chances of not having to trade our freedom or our comfort or our security. We don't have to give up anything if we realize that we are responsible for all of it.
Yes. Yes. Exciting. Sherry, we have a caller on the line.
Great.
I'd like to welcome Tom from San Jose. You're on Open Air with Sherry Huber.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Sherry.
Hi,
Hi.
Tom.
I was calling because I have an interesting thing going on with my work.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking with a friend of mine who's 19 years old. I happen to be 31. And I was telling her she needed to get a job. And
did she point out that's not as easy as you might think?
Yeah, exactly. And what I'm noticing is there are a lot of things that came up for me around this. One of the things that came up was I found myself telling her, yes, you have to get a job, and yes, the process is going to be rather demeaning, and it's going to seem very unfair, and all those things, but it's just something you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that word demeaning, those two words, demeaning and unfair, kept going through my mind, and I noticed that there is a part of me that sees all the work that I do at my job as very demeaning and very unfair.
Uh-huh.
And that it's not a good thing. It really makes me unhappy.
Yes. Yes. Now, when you heard yourself saying this, did it come as a surprise to you, or did you realize immediately that that's how you feel about it?
Well, I realized immediately that that's how I felt about it, but I didn't understand the ramifications of that.
Uh-huh.
How much it affected me.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes. So you go to work every day and do something all day long that is demeaning and unfair.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this part of me that's always there in my ear. Oh, that's so unfair. Oh, that's so demeaning.
Uh-huh. And now, I'm sorry, I'm still not clear. Were you aware of this before the conversation with your friend? In other words, could you, have there been opportunities to ask that voice in your head, where does this perspective come from?
Not so much.
Uh-huh.
Not so much to sit and examine it.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly did not seem like I hadn't heard it before.
Yes.
But it certainly hasn't been checked before.
Uh-huh. So, tomorrow is going to be an interesting day at work, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Because having an opportunity to be in conversation with this person who, and maybe it's two people, you know, one who has demeaning as an issue and the other who has unfair as an issue.
Right.
Maybe it's the same voice talking about both of those.
Right.
But just trying to get a sense of where is this coming from?
Right.
Yeah.
And noticing that in seeing it and processing it without, you know, after having said this to her, just makes me think, boy, the effect this could have could be enormous because, I mean, what a terrible feeling for someone to have. I guess I feel moved with compassion of how terrible it has to be for someone to have this in their ear all day long,
yeah.
Every day.
Yeah, and to try to go there and do a good job and be a good sport and
right.
And an upbeat member of the team and all of that.
That's right.
With that kind of message.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just see somebody white-knuckling their way through it.
Oh. Well, and if it were me, being resentful and angry and bitter and a lot of unpleasant things as
right.
a result of that, because demeaning and unfair, I mean, that's heavy-duty stuff.
Yes.
You know, unfair, now we can hear that, oh, well, you know, so-and-so got to do that, and I only got to do that, that's really unfair, but demeaning,
mm-hmm.
Ooh, I mean, that speaks right to your self-worth.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, that what I think doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
That it's only what my manager thinks that matters.
Mm-hmm.
And if I just do what he wants, then I'll be okay.
Yeah, yeah. And, Tom, let me ask you this. Were you excited about this job when you got it?
Yes, very much.
Uh-huh. So you went out there and found this job and...
That's right.
...picked it out of all the others.
That's right.
And would you want your manager's job?
Yeah, I would.
Uh-huh. So you feel like you could do a better job than he's doing.
I would say so, yeah. I have that common experience.
Yeah, which feeds into this kind of thing, doesn't it?
It sure does.
Yeah.
That's been coming up a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And have you ever been in that position before?
Yeah, I would say that I have been.
Uh-huh.
Where I feel like I'm asking someone to do something they're not completely into.
Yeah, because you have to have the company's... You're representing the company's viewpoint, not the employee's viewpoint.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I also see myself perpetuating that myth to this other person who I'm talking to.
Yes.
You know, that yes, it's very, work in general is a demeaning place.
Yeah, it's demeaning and unfair, so go on out there and be a player.
That's right.
It's like, it's very parental, isn't it?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, yeah. It's miserable, but I did it, and so you just have to do it too.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Wow, and how very helpful.
See it more clearly with her there, trying to help her through the process, it puts it out there for me to see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to see it very clearly.
And one of the things that I hear in this, I don't know if this is true or if I'm just projecting it, but there's a part of you that suspects that this voice may have an axe that it's grinding that really has nothing to do with what's going on.
Yes, very much so.
Because no matter what's happening, it's demeaning and unfair.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it very much goes along with what you were saying about anything other than ending suffering is not ending suffering, because what this part of me is being told to do is, yes, it's demeaning, yes, it's unfair, but you still have to end suffering.
Aha.
But you can't do them both at the same time. You can't have this whole agenda of demeaning and this whole agenda of unfair and end suffering at the same time.
That's right. Because if you end suffering, then you have to drop the demeaning unfair.
That's right.
Yeah. And that person who's talking to you has no interest in that.
Exactly. And very, very little interest in that.
Yeah. And again, it's what I heard was the ability to distinguish that it's not you. It's a voice that's talking about you.
Right.
It's talking to you, about you. It's not a part of you that says, this is so demeaning. This is so unfair to me. I feel so demeaned by this. I feel that this is unfair to me. It's the voice of an agitator.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's so unfair.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Just kind of stirring you up.
That's right. I have to laugh because, I mean, even just to hear those words makes me just go, "Urgh."
Mm-hmm.
And it really feels familiar.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you let us know, won't you?
Yes, I will.
Because this is going to get exciting.
Yeah. I hope so.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. And so, you know, if it were me going to work, I would need to write this down on something, because I would suspect that those voices for me would be doing anything to keep this from staying in front of conscious awareness.
Yeah, that's a very good idea.
Yeah, so they might have nothing to say tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
And it'll be 2 or 3 days before you hear that again, and by then, you know, the whole thing is kind of closed over, and it's not as charged, and they just slip back in and start agitating for unrest again.
Right.
Yeah, so maybe a little sign that says, what about this is demeaning?
Uh-huh.
You know, or how is this unfair?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, or even, what does unfair mean?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because as I'm fond of pointing out, we cannot actually talk about unfair.
Uh-huh.
You know, if we were having our fair share of life, we would be living in some squalid circumstances somewhere.
Right.
You know, hand to mouth, trying to feed the kids. And you know, if we took life and divided everything out and made it fair.
That's right.
Yeah, we would not be having these discussions or these problems.
That's right. I see that.
Yeah, but what we do, of course, is to look at this very privileged minority that we live in, and then we want what's fair within that.
Yes, I see.
Yeah.
That it's very much a matter of perspective.
Yeah, yeah, because, you know, the first, when you were telling your friend to get a job, I thought, boy, what a lucky person to have a job, to be able to advise somebody else to get a job. You know, because I'm sure you know an awful lot of people now who are looking for jobs.
Yes,
who
absolutely.
Used to be employed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just to have a little conversation with that part, you know, what is it about this that's demeaning?
Uh-huh.
You know, and what does unfair mean?
Right.
Yeah.
That could be very helpful.
Yeah, and not, you know, as always, not letting it slide into self-hatred, because that's where it would go next. You know, what is wrong with you that you're talking about unfair and demeaning when you are so fortunate and so privileged, you are so out of touch with reality, and turn the whole thing against you as if it was your idea in the first place?
Right.
Okay, well, keep us posted.
Okay, I will. Thanks, Sherry.
Thanks, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us, Tom. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber. I'm your host, Michael Gray. If you'd like to join our conversation today, if you have an opinion about what unfair is or what is unfair.
Yeah, and let's talk about demeaning.
Let's talk about unfair and demeaning. The phone number is 650-723-9010. We're going to take a quick break. Stay tuned to KZSU Stanford at 6 p.m. DJ Decca has some more great world music. At 9 p.m. we have the Bot of Euphony. And I'd like to mention once again that archives of Open Air with Sherry Huber are now available on Sherry's website, which is sherryhuber.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Open Air with Sherry Huber. I'm your host, Michael Gray. You can join our conversation today by calling 650-723-9010. Sherry, the last caller was talking about unfair and demeaning Tom, and he was talking about it in the context of what we often talk about as projection.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could say a little bit about that. You're sort of talking around that.
Yeah. Because in this case, the only place it's happening is with Tom.
Right.
Right. So there's a clue for us. In other words, the manager doesn't come in and say, I know that this is unfair and demeaning, but I'm going to ask you to do it anyway. And so when we realize, as it sounds like Tom has really come to consciousness about, that this whole internal process is going on, then we can look at the source of it, which is what it sounds like he's going to do. Now, who is that person talking to me? There's a voice in my ear all the time talking about unfair and demeaning, and labeling my life experiences that way. Ah, well, now who is that, and what would all of this look like if that voice weren't labeling it that way? What would this look like? What does this look like from my boss's perspective? What does it look like from a coworker's perspective? And so I'm the one projecting unfair and demeaning.
Right.
Those are my words. That's my experience for it. So where does that come from in me? And of course, I think the point that Tom made that's so helpful for all of us is that what is it like to go to work every day in those circumstances?
Yes.
When somebody is labeling what you're doing demeaning and unfair, and then you have to go there and do all of these demeaning, unfair things all day long and try to keep up your morale.
Yeah. Sounds miserable.
Yeah.
Yes.
So anything like that, and when he said it sounds familiar, those words are familiar.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're always using familiar words. We just don't hear them.
Yes.
So if we can hear ourselves saying I remember years ago, this woman came to the to group at the Zen Center, and she said that she'd been working with an employee, and the employee said came in, asked to talk to her, came in and sat down and said, "You know, everyone here is bored. You know, the people in this company are bored. It's because it's boring. What we're doing is boring." And fortunately, she understood projection, and she said, "Well, now, can you be more specific?" And so, you know, the woman went through this whole list. Every employee, they were bored. They were all bored. They were all having the same experience. And finally, she said, "Well, now, let me ask you this. Are you bored?" And the woman said, "Yes, I'm bored because this." And so rather than needing to take it personally, and rather than needing to believe that this was a global experience, it was possible to see that, in fact, this woman was really bored.
And
projecting
boredom,
it out onto everyone and everything.
Yes, yes.
And when we're in that kind of experience, it's so difficult to imagine that everybody isn't having it.
Right.
It's one of my favorite things to do when working with a group of people is somebody will say something like that, and then I just ask the group for a reality check. You know, is that your experience? Is that the label you would use? Is that how you would talk about it? Not as a way of pounding it in that you're really wrong about this, but we have so few opportunities to check something like that out. And so to be in a group of people having an experience and then have a whole room full of people say, "Well, my experience actually is da-da-da-da-da," it's like, wow, so this is just me. This is just my reality. I'm projecting this out. And if the person is really present, so I've been projecting onto all of you that you're having the same experience that I'm having, and you're telling me that you're not. So I need to rethink a lot of my reality.
Yes.
What if this is always true? What if other people are living in a different world from the one that I'm living in?
Uh-huh. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's sobering.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
As Tom was talking about, his experience of work is unfair and demeaning. And to his boss, it could be uplifting.
Exciting.
World-changing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. Or yeah. It could be unfair and demeaning. But the thing about it is, probably the boss has a boss. And,
right.
You know, very often those kinds of things get passed down.
Yes.
So it would just be, of course, most workplaces you can't be quite that honest. But it would be fascinating to find out what how does the boss see it? You know, what does it look like from that angle? And as Tom said, he's been in that position and knows what it's like to need to ask people to do things that they're not really into and wouldn't really choose and don't actually enjoy, which I suppose is the nature of a job. You know, we take a job and what we trade is money for our time and energy and expertise. And I think it's hard for all of us to remember that that's what we've agreed to do.
Uh-huh.
You know,
that
yes,
we
I
choose
like,
that.
Yeah, yeah, that you hired me and you're going to pay me X amount of money and I'm going to take your money and you're going to tell me what you want me to do.
Right.
And then, you know, I like the money, but once we get into this, then, you know, now I want more say about what I do and I want to enjoy it more and I... You know, I really resent the fact that you and I lose sight of the fact that, but that's the agreement that we made. that's what we agreed to originally.
Yeah. And by the way, how about some more money?
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, we talk about this a lot with aspects of the personality.
I was just going to go there. Yes.
Yeah. That one person wants the job. So I come to you and I apply for your job and you hire me. And that's really all this part of me wants. I wanted to get the job. I got the job. Yay.
Yes.
But, of course, who's going to go to work? Now I've got to find somebody who's going to go to work.
Right. And someone inside ourselves.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it would be nice if I could find somebody who will go to work and like the job.
Yes.
But, see, that's a different set of needs.
Yes.
So if my need was to get the job, then when that need is met and that part goes away, I might be left with nobody who actually wants to go to work and do the job.
Yes.
So it can get very, very difficult for us if we're not aware of those kinds of transitions. So, you know, I can certainly find somebody inside of me who likes to go to work, who likes to work,
yes.
do work. Doesn't really. Most of us have somebody who just likes to do work or be busy or have projects or whatever it is. And so I can ask that person to come in and come to work.
Yes.
But then, of course, most of us have people who are dissatisfied and and not pleased and feel like we deserve more or have other things that we want to be doing. Yes, I need to make money, but I don't want to spend all of my time doing the things that I need to do to make money. I would be having a nicer life if I were doing something else, this other thing, but I can't make a living doing this other thing. So I go to work for you, but I really resent you because I have to go to work for you for the money, but where my heart is really over there. And then I start blaming you that I can't make a living doing something that I would really enjoy, and it gets very complex.
Mm, sounds ugly.
Yes.
Yes.
Exhausting.
Exhausting. Mm-hmm. Miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Sherry, I've heard you talk before about aspects of the personality. And one metaphor that you've used that I really find helpful is looking at the clothes in the closet or the shoes in our closet.
Mm-hmm.
So I have shoes that I go to work in.
Mm-hmm.
I have shoes that I'm casual in.
Mm-hmm.
I have sports shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And along with those shoes, I have various sort of personas or aspects of myself that come out.
Yeah. And so I think you have a runner personality.
Yes.
And so he has his outfit and he has his shoes. And you really don't want him to get dressed up and go to work.
Right.
Yeah, or get dressed up and go out on the town.
Yes.
Because not only would the clothes be inappropriate, but he would be inappropriate.
Yes.
He's not interested in going out in the town or going to work. He's interested in running.
Yes.
And he might not get to run as much as he wants to. That's true. He might be angling to run more than he gets a chance to run, but that doesn't mean he's interested in going out and doing these other things.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the person who wants to go to work, who likes to go to work, who enjoys that, if you're lucky enough to have somebody like that, that person usually doesn't want to go running.
Yes, right.
Yeah, he may run around a lot, but he's not going to put on shorts and tennis shoes and go do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber. If you'd like to join our conversation today, please give us a call. The number is 650-723-9010. We've been talking about projection, various aspects of the personality. Earlier, we were talking about worry and security. And Sherry, our earlier conversation reminded me of a quote of yours, and it is, "Live to be in the present. Safety, security, knowing, and being right are all synonyms for death."
Mm. Yeah. There's not much movement in any of those, is there?
In safety, security, knowing, being right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
There's not a lot of, as we used to say in the 60s, going with the flow.
Yeah. I imagine sort of a contraction, like a getting smaller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Making our world small enough that we can control it. That mm-hmm. we know what's going to happen, that we can be right, that we can be sure, that we can be safe. And so the image, I think it's a Buddhist image, but it would work anywhere, I suppose. You know, you go to the river, and it's so beautiful. You're sitting there by the river, and it's just so beautiful and peaceful, and you decide that you would like to take some of it home with you. So you scoop up a container of it, and you take it home with you.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, not only immediately, it would be possible to notice that you had missed the point utterly. But if you didn't get it immediately, then as time goes by and the water sits there and it becomes putrid and it begins to smell and becomes slimy and all of those things, then it's really clear that the river is the river.
Uh-huh.
You can't possess it. You can't own it. You can't take it with you. You can't.
Uh-huh.
You can't do those things, and you can't do that with life. So if we try to close off life into a little package that we can possess, then we don't have life. We have death at that point.
Yes.
Yeah. And yes. And whether we recognized it or not, we're dead.
Yes.
Because all we're doing is focusing on a dead thing, which is our conditioning.
Yes.
Conditioning is dead.
Yes.
It has already happened. It's being repeated over and over and over and over.
Right.
But there's no life in it.
There's nothing new,
there's
creative,
that's right.
Original.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. As you were talking about the river, I was thinking about, as you talk about pushing and pulling being the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to pull or hold on to experiences that I like, I try to push away experiences that I don't like, and they're both a way of clinging or trying to control.
Yes, of being separate from what's going on.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't like those circumstances. I avoid those circumstances. And I pursue those other circumstances. I really like that. And so the image that I always get to with this is a building. And the building stands up because there's an equal pressure of the walls inward and outward.
Uh-huh.
If there were too much pressure inward, they would just collapse inside the building. If there's too much pressure out, they would fall over outside the building. And so the building is held up by a perfect balance of the inside and the outside.
Yes.
And that's what you're talking about with the pushing and pulling. So I push that away. I don't want that. I do want that. And that equal pressure keeps my identity intact, keeps my identity upright.
Yes.
And it's true that as we begin to let go of that, we also are letting go of our identity.
Uh-huh.
But if we keep in mind that our identity is a dead thing,
yes,
then it's good.
Right.
It's good to let it go because before it becomes like the water in the container, before it gets putrid and begins to smell.
Yes.
And we know that experience. We know it in ourselves and we know it in others. When people have clung to something, clung to a rigid way of being way past a good time to cling to it.
Yes.
And it becomes ugly.
Yes.
But if we can let go, even though that first letting go for identity is very frightening and painful, as soon as we begin to let go and let life become fluid again, as soon as there's movement again, then we can move with it. Now it's a living thing. Now it's exciting, challenging, and fun.
And changing,
yeah.
And we're present to it.
Yeah.
And there's uncertainty,
yeah.
Which can be seen as exciting.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
It's life.
It's life.
Yeah. So there's, if we think about, there's existence, and one side of existence is life, and the other side of existence is death. That's the duality. Mm-hmm. The duality, and what contains that duality is existence.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And
contains both life and death.
Yes.
Yes.
And so as we move with the flow of that, we can embrace life and death. It all becomes easy. It all becomes manageable. So the moment of death is just the next moment of life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Sounds a lot less stressful.
Yes.
Less it clinging is, and grasping.
It is less stressful. The yes. stress of life is trying to make something happen that isn't happening.
Yes.
Or keep something from happening that is happening.
Yes.
Yeah. And yes. So we tense up our little puny little muscles against life and try to make something be the way our conditioning yes. thinks it should be, and it's brutal. Miserable.
Number one, it doesn't work.
Number one, it doesn't work.
Number two,
it doesn't work.
Number two, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And it's miserable.
Yeah, it's miserable and painful.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you'd like to call us and talk about miserable and painful before the end of the hour, please do so. The number is 650-723-9010, coming up at 6 o'clock. DJ Deck is here. She's going to have some great world music. And then at 9 p.m. we have the Bot of Euphony. I'm going to put in one more plug for our archives of this show. Open Air with Sherry Huber are now available on sherryhuber.com. It's spelled CHERIHUBER.com. We've been talking about a lot of different stuff today.
Mm-hmm. Because life contains a lot of different stuff. So we have to be flexible and lively and moving in our coverage of it.
Yes, yes. Wonderful. Sherry, we have another caller on the line. I'd like to welcome Lori from Mountain View. You're on Open Air with Sherry Huber.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
Good evening.
You were talking earlier to someone about work who felt demeaning and unfair.
Yes.
And what I notice looking at my issues with work is there's a lot of overwhelm.
Uh-huh.
It almost seems that no matter what I'm asked to do, there's a sense of it's more than I can do.
Yes.
And so what I tend to do is not do it.
Yes.
Which doesn't work very well being a freelance person.
No. No, it doesn't. It actually wouldn't work very well no matter what you were doing, right?
Good point.
Yeah. And, you know, earlier Michael was talking about one process not leading to another.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurs to me that that's exactly what you're up against with this. That there's the belief that that feeling of overwhelm has something to do with the content of your life.
That's very believable,
mm-hmm.
even now.
Yes, yes. And the thing that frees us is getting it, that overwhelm is simply something that you do. Now, I would talk about it as a karmic predisposition. And I'll give you an example of it. When I went into the monastery where I trained, I realized after a period of time that every morning I would wake up feeling guilty. Every morning, and for much of my life, that was a valid emotion to be having when I woke up. But I was in a monastery. I was not doing anything that I could remotely convince myself I should feel guilty about. And yet, I woke up every morning feeling guilty. And I got it, that it was a karmic predisposition. It was a habit. And that I would feel that way regardless of my life circumstances for as long as I would feel that way. And at that point, I began to disassemble the structure of guilt.
So it didn't have content that was believable at that point?
No, it didn't. Now, of course, what it could do if I caught on to it, and that's the whole point. You know, we're not meant to catch on to these things.
Uh-huh.
But if I would catch on to it, it would go back. It would try to go back into the past. You see, when it was current in my life, I could just, you know, go back to the day before and go, oh, I can't believe I did that, or whatever. But living in a monastery, there was just no content for it to attach to. So then it would go back to, well, remember when you, or, you know, you did this or that, and it would try to play scenes from my past that I would feel bad or guilty about. And I got it, that it was just a habit, and it was a habit of suffering. So what is this feeling? You know, this is part of when I began to catch on to, where am I feeling this in my body? What's the label that goes with this? What's the emotional reaction? And then, you know, what is the behavior? And so with the overwhelm in the same way, it's a habit. It doesn't actually have anything to do with what's going on. You could go to work for somebody else. You could come into a ton of money and not have to work for anybody, and I can promise you, you would feel the same way. That regularly, you would feel overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I used to feel that way as an employee. I always felt like I was on the verge of being fired for being inadequate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we get to that kind of realization, it's like what Tom was talking about. You know, we get to that level of realization, and we have no choice but to begin to take apart that structure.
And it's looking at the questions. I remember you asked Tom something about what does it mean to be unfair? And
yes.
Like, what is overwhelming?
What is overwhelming? What is overwhelming about this?
Uh-huh.
What does that mean, overwhelming? And really break it down, because I think you're going to find it unbelievable. Like if I said, now, is this a job that you couldn't do? You would say, no, I have all the skills to do it.
Well, actually, I wouldn't say that.
Uh-huh.
I think that I probably do, but everything I do is different, and I would say about this project I'm starting now, you know, I don't really know what I'm doing, and I don't know if I can do it, and that all sounds very believable to me.
Yes, which is not the same as overwhelm, is it?
No, so, but somehow it leads to the
Yeah, that's right, and that's the piece that you want, right? Because what you're describing is that all roads lead to overwhelm. Right? So why are you overwhelmed about this? Well, you're not really sure that you know what you're doing. Why were you overwhelmed when you were an employee? Well, because they were going to find out that you're inadequate and not really capable of doing the job, and they're going to fire you. And then what's going to happen to you? Okay? So if you had all the money in the world and you didn't have to work, you would be overwhelmed by the fact that you had no structure in your life and you didn't really know what to do with yourself, and how are you going to handle all of this money, and There would be a way for you to get to overwhelm.
And I'm going to trust you on that, because it doesn't feel like I would feel that way.
I know. That's a huge part of the belief system. And that's why life almost never lets us out of the ruts that we're in. Do you know what I mean?
No.
Well, that it almost, our conditioning almost, did I say life? I didn't mean that. Oh, I didn't mean that.
Huh?
It's our conditioning that won't let us out of the ruts. Because if we get out of the ruts, we are liable to have the kind of experience that I described to you with the guilt. You'll be having an experience of overwhelm, and there's nothing to hang it on. And as soon as you have that experience, you get it, that this overwhelm has nothing to do with content. That there's always a story that can be plugged into, but you've had the experience of overwhelm when there was no content to apply it to. And so you know it is just something that you do.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that's why karma has us choose the same things over and over and over and over, even though they are things that don't work, don't make us happy, are not fulfilling, are not satisfying, but we are required by conditioning to do them over and over and over again. Okay? Because those structures keep all of this that we're talking about believable. So as long as your life is the same, you can believe that it's overwhelming.
And if I were to suddenly move to a monastery, I might not be able to.
That's right. If you were suddenly to move to a monastery, what would become clear to you is that you do a process of overwhelm. Because you do it at the monastery.
Uh-huh.
Yeah? So...
And I have done it at the monastery.
Very good. Okay, I can rest my case. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So now, just as we were saying with Tom, now your work is to take it apart.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and it's what I was talking about with comfort. You know, when you dismantle this, and overwhelm is no longer an issue for you, and I'll just tell you my own personal little way of doing this, okay? And it may be helpful to you, and it may not. But one of the things that I will do with any kind of trait that's like that is that I will say to myself, this is what karma feels like. So if that were me, I would watch that overwhelm, and I would say, this is what karma feels like. This is how I am controlled.
Yeah, that's helpful because that immediately sparks somebody who wants to work through it.
Exactly.
That's very helpful.
Yeah. So every time it arises, this is what karma feels like. This is not real. It's not true. It's karma.
Mm-hmm.
And then you, from that, just that little bit of stepped backness, the ability then to look and see what's really going on. I'm being controlled by this. Okay. So I will say, you know, if like through the years training with anger, I would say, this is ego. This is what ego feels like. You see, that ends the conversation about he did that and she said that and
yeah.
I'm right and they're wrong or I'm wrong and they're right or if those
yeah.
guys. This is ego asserting itself.
Yeah.
Okay, this is, then we can cut to the chase.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's very helpful.
Good.
Thank you.
Let me know.
I will.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us, Loy. We've come to the end of our hour here.
My goodness, it flies.
Time is flying. Great. Sherry, do you have some homework for our listeners to look at?
Well.
And call us on next week?
I don't know. I suppose, when I consider it, that I would like for people to identify something along the lines of what Tom and Lori have looked at. For Lori, it was, this feels overwhelming.
Uh-huh.
For Tom, the demeaning and unfair. Mm-hmm. Do people have language like that that keeps them in a certain, what I would call, karmic orientation to life that they could identify?
Uh-huh.
Or the boring woman.
You know,
is there something that you say over and over and over and over and over, a place that you keep finding yourself,
right,
that you, instead of believing, you could begin to identify as a karmic orientation?
Yes, and something habitual,
yeah,
something familiar.
Yeah, conditioned, place that you get over and over and over, an attitude about people or work or yourself or anything. And just see if you could begin to experience it as... karma or conditioning rather than truth or reality.
Right. Rather than me.
Me. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exciting.
And just call us and let us know what it is. You know, what's the word? What's the phrase that you say, that you hear yourself saying over and over, that keeps putting you in the same kind of place?
Yes. Yes. Wonderful. Call us next week. That number is 650-723-9010. If you'd like to get in touch with us in the meantime, drop us an email at openair@kzsu.org. And we're very excited because we have archives of this show, Open Air with Sherry Huber, now available on the internet anytime, 24 hours a day. That website is sherryhuber.com, sherryhuber.com. There are several buttons on the homepage there that will take you to that place. I'd like to thank Jay and Lori and Michael for all their help today.
Our staff.
Our staff.
We are blessed with two Michaels on one show.
Yes.
Yes. So that people
Michael
don't
squared.
Think you're thanking yourself for all of your work on the show.
Well, I mean, I would like to.
But I'll thank you instead.
Okay.
How's that? Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Sherry.
See you next time.
Coming up next, we have DJ Decca with some great world music. and we'll talk to you next week.